Our two debaters this evening, as you well know, are Dr. John Cobb and Dr. Norman Geisler. Dr. Geisler is currently the professor of systematic theology at Dallas Theological Seminary. His bachelor and master's degree are from Wheaton College, a theology degree of Bible from Detroit Bible College, and a PhD in philosophy from Loyola University of Chicago. During his career, he has served on the faculties of Detroit Bible College, of Trinity College, and of Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. A number of important works have been authored by Dr. Geisler, including Christian Ethic of Love, Philosophy of Religion, From God to Us, Christian Apologetics, The Root of Evil. Recently, in the last few years, he edited a document called Inerrancy, which was, I remember, was provided on the basis, on the behalf of the International Council of Biblical Errancy, Inerrancy. There's a difference there, I suppose. In addition to his professional work as a philosopher and as a theologian and as a spokesman for Christian apologetics, he's also been a very active churchman. He served as campus minister and as pastor. He's an ordained minister within the Evangelical Free Church and is still active as a minister and as a churchman. Dr. John Cobb is currently Ingram Professor of Theology at the School of Theology Claremont and the Avery Professor at Claremont Graduate School. His academic degrees come from the University of Michigan, University of Chicago, and University of Chicago Divinity School, where he earned the PhD degree. In addition, he has served on other faculties as well as being a visiting professor at both European and American universities. Among the more important works, or the more noted works that he's written, have included Christian Natural Theology, The Structure of Christian Existence, God and the World, a book co-authored with David Griffin entitled Process Theology, and a book co-edited with James Robinson entitled The New Hermeneutics. And in recent years has been very active in exploring new ground as to the applicability of process thought to other dimensions of Christian life and Christian thought. Likewise, Dr. Cobb has been a very active churchman. He was born and raised in Japan of Methodist missionaries. Been very active in the United Methodist Church through his years as both professor and as churchman. As you see in your outline for tonight, there is a format which will follow. Their initial presentations will take 20 minutes, at which point then they will also follow with rebuttals. Dr. Cobb will start the debate at this point.
Since I'm on home ground here on this campus, I would like to add my word of welcome, especially to those of you who are here for the first time. We have many interesting events here, and I hope you will find your way back on other occasions. I want particularly to express my appreciation to Dr. Geisler for making the trip from Texas for this event, only I understand it came from Florida for this event. Since I am speaking first, I will take the occasion to explain why some of us have been dissatisfied with what in the title of the debate is called Orthodox Theology, or in another form, Orthodox Theism. I would prefer to name what I am criticizing Classical Theism. Another title has been added is God Finite, but focusing on that terminology might lead to confusion. I do not myself hold that God is finite, and I do not think that Dr. Geisler does so. On the other hand, neither of us would want to say that God is infinite without any qualification at all. The issues between us would be the ways in which we would qualify the affirmation that God is infinite. But these might not bring out the primary reasons process theologians are dissatisfied with classical theism. Hence, I will focus instead on the relation of God to time. It is its emphasis on the importance of temporal passage, even to God, that gives to process theology its name. Classical theism is one of the truly great accomplishments of the human mind and spirit. It began to take form in the early centuries of Christianity as believers struggled to integrate biblical faith with the great achievements of Greek and Hellenistic philosophy. It was brought to its fullest expression in the High Middle Ages, most theologians agree that St. Thomas Aquinas gave it its finest articulation. Historically, the most important critique of classical theism has come from those Christians who deplore the effort to integrate philosophical and biblical thinking. They argue that the God of the philosophers is not the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The Protestant reformers went far in this direction, although in their actual formulations they were more influenced by the philosophical tradition than they realized. In the 20th century, such neo-Reformation theologians as Karl Barth have gone still further to purge theology of its Greek philosophical elements. In this debate, my sympathies are more with classical theology. For me, all thought needs to be unified. Theology and philosophy cannot be separated into airtight compartments. But this does not mean to me that the wisest path today is to maintain the alliance of biblical thought with Greek philosophy. There are two reasons for this judgment. First, Greek philosophy was closely related to Greek science and mathematics. Through the Middle Ages, this was still the best science and mathematics available. That is not true today. We need philosophies that are better integrated into the best thinking of our own time. Second, and really more important for our purposes today, there are tensions between the values the Greeks expressed in their philosophy and the biblical vision of God and the world. The issue of time is important both in relating ourselves to modern knowledge and in relation to our most fundamental values. In the Bible, time is very real, and God's involvement with the world is temporal through and through. Past is past, present is present, and future is future, alike for us and for God. History is of utmost importance. The meaning of events is found in their locus in the history of God with God's people. The most influential forms of Greek thought saw time quite differently. It was inherently a problem. What is good and desirable is not fulfillment in time, whether in this life or the next, but non-temporal being, eternity in the strict sense of that term. It is the eternal in the sense of that which is not affected by time at all that is truly real. The eternal has no concern with the temporal, although temporal beings long for the eternal. Thus, Aristotle's God is completely unmoved by what happens in the world. According to his philosophy, God contemplates eternally God's own eternal blessedness and blissful indifference to suffering creatures. When the Church Fathers forged a synthesis of biblical and Greek thought of God, they made a fateful choice. They believed that the Greek notion of the eternal as the non-temporal was more profound than the biblical notion of God's everlastingness, God's beginningless and endless endurance through all time. Hence, classical theism is basically committed to the view that God, like a Platonic form, for example, that is, like a pure idea not contaminated with matter, is radically beyond time. Now, there is nothing absurd or immoral about such a choice. We process theologians agree that there are aspects of God that are eternal in this sense. God's character, for example, is unchanging in an eternal sense. God is eternally omnipresent, eternally all-loving, eternally all-knowing. What happens in time has no effect on God's fundamental nature or character. But we insist that when we think of God in God's full personal actuality, we should think with the Bible that God is everlastingly interacting with the creatures. Indeed, it is because God is all-loving and all-knowing that God is moved by the suffering of human beings and responds to it. It is the inability of classical theism to make these statements without severe qualifications that bothers us. Of course, classical theists do not agree with Aristotle that God is ignorant of the world and indifferent to it. Their task has been to synthesize the biblical view of God's interaction with the world with the Greek view that God is wholly beyond time and unaffected by what happens to the creatures. There has been much brilliant speculation dealing with this difficult problem. For example, how can that which is radically non-temporal have knowledge of what goes on in the world temporally? For God to know that something is going on now, that 5 minutes ago God knew was not happening, would be to introduce time into God in a way that the strict doctrine of eternity forbids. The solution of classical theists is usually to assert that for God, time is not real. For God, events that are for us past, present, and future are all eternally co-present. It is as if from the air an entire road up a mountain could be seen at once, whereas the hiker sees only what is immediately ahead. For God, all that will ever happen for us is happening now. For classical theists, our future is eternally present for God. Closely related to this is the classical theist's idea of God's impassibility or passionlessness. To be affected by others is, for the Greeks, a sign of weakness. To be beyond time is to be free from being affected by anything that happens. The task of classical theologians was to recognize this impassibility of God with the biblical teaching of God's love and compassion. Let me offer you a quote from one of the great classical theologians to show how this problem was felt and treated. The quote is from the Proslogium of St. Anselm, where St. Anselm is addressing God with some perplexity. "But how art thou compassionate, and at the same time passionless? For if thou art passionless, thou dost not feel sympathy. And if thou dost not feel sympathy, thy heart is not wretched from sympathy for the wretched. But this it is to be compassionate. But if thou art not compassionate, whence cometh so great consolation to the wretched? How then art thou compassionate and not compassionate, O Lord, unless because thou art compassionate in terms of our experience and not compassionate in terms of thy being? Truly, thou art so in terms of our experience, but thou art not so in terms of thine own." We can admire St. Anselm for his brilliance, but to me it seems unfortunate that he had to deny that God is compassionate in God's own being and experience. In human relations, it is important that people act compassionately toward us, but it is also important that we know that the actions express real sympathy on their part. Why should we suppose that in relation to God, this is not so? I see no biblical reason for this denial. The denial stems from an aspect of the Greek heritage that seems to me to impede the expression of the gospel rather than facilitate it. I think we can do better. I think we can benefit from the work of some recent philosophers who have, ultimately under the influence of the Bible, taken time as fundamentally real and important and abandoned the view that it is more excellent to be untouched by others than to be moved by what happens to them. Process theologians are those who make use of the work of these philosophers in the formulation of the biblical vision of God and the world. Process theologians hold that time is real for God as well as for the creatures, and that God's compassion is felt both by God and by us. Among the 20th century philosophers who have broken with the Greek suspicion of temporal process, Alfred North Whitehead is the one who has won the largest following among theologians. I follow Whitehead partly because he has done the best job of correlating our thinking about ourselves and God with the best modern knowledge gained through the sciences and mathematics. But I follow him also because the values that guide his formulations are, in my view, highly congenial to biblical thought. Indeed, they are at a deep level inspired by the Bible and especially by Jesus. It would be absurd to suppose that Whitehead has brought the history of thought to a final conclusion, There are problems and loose ends in his philosophy. There are additional problems for those who would integrate biblical thought with what they learn from him into a new theology. I'm sure Dr. Geisler will point out some of these problems, so we will be able to discuss them further. I can assure you that we who are called process theologians have heated debates among ourselves. But on some points, many of us are agreed that God truly cares for us, that God suffers with us in our suffering and rejoices with us in our joy, that God hears our prayers and truly responds to them, that our lives matter ultimately because they matter to God, that we are truly called by God, but that we often refuse the call, that how we respond to the call of God affects the course of history. We find that the Greek elements in classical theism inhibit the unequivocal affirmation of such truths, and we appreciate being freed from these restrictions. Even more valuable for my theological reflection than the specifics of Whitehead's doctrine of God is his reflection on how God is related to us. Classical theism has, of course, wrestled with this question. For Thomas, the most fundamental answer is that God is being itself. We participate in God as we participate in being. This is all very well, but in comparison with biblical modes of thought, it seems to me quite general and vague. There is another stream of classical theism that does not emphasize God as being itself, but instead God as sovereign will. This theme is not absent in St. Thomas, but it is much stronger in William of Ockham and in the Protestant reformers who followed him. Here the idea is that whatever happens in the world is ultimately just what God wills to happen, even in the case of human sin. In this vision, creatures relate to God not so much through participation in God's being as in inevitable conformation to God's holy, controlling will. This emphasis certainly has more specificity of meaning. Further, it has clearer roots in a few biblical passages. But unless it is severely qualified, it leads to conclusions that are difficult to reconcile with many other biblical passages. It is hard to reconcile the idea of God's all-controlling will with human freedom and responsibility. It is even harder to reconcile it with God's compassionate love. Of course, much brilliant speculation has been directed to just such reconciliation by classical theists. The question raised by process theists is not so much whether classical theists have succeeded in achieving an intelligible doctrine, but whether the best we can do is to set up the task for theology in such a way that this problem confronts us so immediately and so forcefully. Process theologians offer a third view of how God relates fundamentally to creatures. It begins with grace rather than with being or control. Grace brings us into being, liberates us, directs us, empowers us, judges us, forgives us, and saves us. Whitehead shows, in a way we do not find in classical theism, how God's participation in the constitution of our lives moment by moment does all these things. We think that grace provides a focus for reflection on how God relates to creatures that is both more biblical and more appropriate to our time. Another valuable contribution of Whitehead to theology is his illumination of how we know God. Most classical theists, dependent on Aristotle, teach that our knowledge of God is an inference from sense experience. According to them, we believe, either on the authority of the church or through being persuaded by rational arguments grounded ultimately in sense experience. Whitehead, in contrast, holds that more fundamental than sensory experience is non-sensory experience. The sense organs give specialized and intensified form to a relatedness that is much more inclusive. Certainly, sensory input dominates the conscious aspects of experience. But underlying this sensory information is the non-sensory. Our basic experience of our bodies, for example, is not mediated by our eyes and ears. the impact of our past upon us in each moment is not sensory experience. Whitehead holds that in a similar way, in every moment, God is experientially present to us and in us. Knowledge of God is not derived from sense experience. Our problem instead is to articulate our deeper knowledge of God in a way that coheres with what we know through sense experience. This seems to me profoundly congruent with biblical thinking. There are, of course, stories in the Bible of God's appearing visibly and audibly to human beings, but far more central and normative is the affirmation of a divine call and address that are immediate to the heart. Obviously, the Bible does not develop a philosophical epistemology, but this does not make it neutral among such epistemologies. The dominance of the idea that all knowledge begins in sense experience and the acceptance by most classical theists of this doctrine have made many biblical teachings difficult to appropriate. Much of the Bible's message can come alive when we understand that sense experience is a secondary and derivative expression of a more basic relationship. God's gracious presence in our lives is not an inference from sense experience, but an immediately given reality. Process theology does not claim to be the last word. On the contrary, it argues that human beings can never speak a last word. Its complaint with classical theism is not that it has failed to serve the church well in many ways, but that by calling itself orthodox theology, it seems to claim that it is the last word. Classical theism may well have been orthodoxy, that is, the right doctrine, or the best that the church could do for 1,000 years or more. But I do not think it is the right doctrine for today. I fear that its familiarity dulls many believers to its problems and limitations, so that they react with immediate hostility when these problems and limitations are pointed out. But real faith is not defensive. It is open to truth from whatever source it comes. We process theologians think it is important to view the quest for understanding on the part of faith as an ongoing adventure in which we are free to explore uncharted seas. The church and all its thinking are in process. For us, process theologians, when we hear severe criticisms of our proposals, find it often painful, and we easily become defensive too. Nevertheless, only as we keep open to criticism can we be faithful to Christ. Dr. Geisler is one of our most knowledgeable critics. I welcome his criticisms with fear, but also with hope.
It is a distinct honor to participate in this dialogue with one of the most prominent process theologians in the world. My role will be to expound classical theology in the tradition of Augustine, Anselm, and Aquinas. My thesis is that process theology of the type held by Whitehead, Hartshorn, and Cobb is unbiblical, unchristian, and incoherent. First of all, I propose that process theology is unbiblical. This should come as no surprise to many process theologians who make no pretense of having a biblical basis for their views. After a comprehensive survey of Whitehead's use of the Bible, Frederick Crownfield frankly acknowledged that there is nothing in this study to indicate that Whitehead got any of his philosophical or religious ideas directly from his contact with the Bible. On the contrary, he concluded that the Bible is used by Whitehead in his own way without regard to its original meaning. After reading thousands of pages of Whitehead, Hartshorn, and Cobb, it is evident that this conclusion applies to all of them. For example, Professor Cobb contends that we cannot simply take the biblical data as the established canon. Why? Because he believes that modern science has made the biblical worldview untenable, and thus we cannot return to the supernaturalist assertion of biblical truth claims. Judging the Bible from within his naturalistic bias, Cobb calls the God of Psalms and Job both dangerous and barbaric. He claims we are no longer bothered by the incredibility of many stories in the Bible or by inconsistencies within it. Indeed, he declares that the immoralities that are sometimes praised cease to disturb us because they are recognized and evaluated by us in the light of other norms. In brief, process theology has admittedly exalted itself above the Bible. Its speculations are the canon by which the Bible is judged, rather than the Bible being the standard by which they are judged. In this most basic sense, process theology is unquestionably unbiblical. Second, I would argue that process theology is not Christian. By this I mean that it does not agree with the biblical or creedal confessions on the person of Jesus Christ. Here, too, many process theologians would concur. Even those who identify with Christianity do not agree with the great Christological creeds. Cobb's Christ, for example, is purely a human person, unique in that he had the same subjective aim or purpose that God had. But this is a far cry from the Christ of Athanasius, Augustine, Anselm, and Aquinas, who is eternally co-equal with the Father in his unchanging nature, his unlimited power, and his divine glory. Further, Cobb admits that his view of the Trinity is unorthodox. He says, the doctrine of the Trinity is an artificial game. It does not even have any special significance in itself, nor is it central to the Christian faith. So by his own confession, Professor Cobb's view is not the historic Christian view of Christ. However, honesty demands that any view that does not affirm the historic Christian position about Christ is not Christian. For one's view of Christ is not a peripheral matter. It is the very heart of Christianity. Hence, no view that denies the deity of Christ is any more Christian than is a view theistic if it denies the existence of God. Furthermore, the process view of Christ is contrary to the claims of and about Christ recorded in the New Testament. John said, "In the beginning was the Word was with God, and the Word was God." When Jesus forgave a man's sins, the Jewish leaders asked, "Who can forgive sins but God alone?" Also, when Jesus claimed to be equal with God by affirming, "I and the Father are one," the Jewish audience attempted to stone him, saying, "Because you, being a mere man, claim to be God." Further, Jesus claimed to be God by accepting worship on no less than 9 occasions. This would be utterly blasphemous for a mere human to do in this monotheistic Jewish context. On one occasion, Jesus blessed Thomas for confessing him as my Lord and my God. In a forceful passage, Jesus claimed to be the Yahweh of Exodus 3:14 when he declared, "Before Abraham was, I am." Here again, the crowd's desire to stone him for blasphemy shows that they clearly understood this as a claim to be the Yahweh of the Old Testament. Jesus also spoke of the glory he had with the Father before the world began. Yet in Isaiah, Yahweh emphatically said, "I am the Lord, that is my name, I will not give my glory to another." So whatever else may be said of the process view of Christ, it is definitely not Christian, for it is neither the view of the Christian creeds nor of Christ himself. Rather, it is a view fabricated to fit their own philosophy. Finally, process theology is not coherent. By this I mean that there are inherent conflicts in its view of truth as well as its view of reality and of God. First, process theology has an incoherent view of truth. Cobb argues, for example, that in the nature of the case, no system of thought is final. All must wait enlargement at the hands of the future. However, the problem is that this amounts to a final statement that no statements are final. It is a claim that all systems are subject to change except the system that affirms that all things change. In short, process theology makes an absolute truth claim that no truth is absolute. But process theology cannot move the world unless it has some place to put its fulcrum. Their very claim that all truth statements are relative is not a relative statement. In a moment of rare candor, Hartshorne admitted, relativity is the absolute. It is as absolute as absoluteness. Herein is the self-defeating nature of the process view of truth. It makes an absolute truth claim that all truth is relative. Second, process theology has an incoherent view of reality. Following Whitehead, Cobb denies any unchanging substance beneath change. In short, all actuality is a ceaseless state of activity beneath which there are no abiding entities. But the concept of change makes no sense unless there is something undergoing the change. It is incoherent to speak of acting without an actor. This is like talking about raining without rain or walking without walking, without anyone walking. Change cannot be process only. There must be something that is changing. If there were change but nothing abiding the change, then each new moment of existence would be a brand new creation. That is, instant by instant, the actual world would be a ceaseless series of annihilations and recreations. Ironically, while process theology denies the classical position that God created the world out of nothing, it inconsistently holds that the world is continually being created anew every instant of its existence. The incoherence of the process view of reality is also manifest in its view that humans have no underlying self or abiding I beneath their experiences. Cobb says, our real self is only a strand of experience in the total flux of experience. But if this is so, then I'm not really experiencing anything. What I call my experience is really not me experiencing anything. Rather, as absurd as it sounds, it is really only experience experiencing experience. Furthermore, if there is no I or continuing self beneath my experiences, then with each changing instant, my self ceases to exist, and the next instant, a brand new self is created. In short, if Professor Cobb is right when he says no abiding person continues to exist from moment to moment, then there was really a different Professor Cobb who began that sentence than the one who finished it. In fact, if he is right, then the Professor Cobb who entered the room is not here on the platform. For there have been hundreds of distinct Professor Cobb spontaneously appearing every split second since he arrived. This view of the human self is not only incoherent, it is self-defeating. For the very precondition of the affirmation that I am not the same I that is uttering this sentence is that I am the same I. Fourth, the process view of God is incoherent, for it claims that God and the world are mutually dependent. In Whitehead's words, it is as true to say that God creates the world as that the world creates God. As Cobb put it, God and the world each presuppose and require the other, so that neither temporal nor ontological priority can be assigned to either. But if this is so, then God and the world simultaneously cause each other. However, process theology cannot have it both ways. For if the God-world complex is causing itself, then it is really self-caused. But a self-caused reality is a contradiction, for a cause must be ontologically prior to its effect. So to cause oneself, you would have to be prior to yourself, which is impossible. Nothing can lift itself by its own ontological bootstraps. Hence, the mutually dependent, self-caused God of process theology is an incoherent concept. Process theologians sometimes attempt to avoid this problem by claiming that God is grounded in creativity. In Whitehead's words, God is a creature transcended by the creativity which it qualifies. However, in this response, the cure is worse than the disease. For this means, as Cobb admits, that God is not ultimate reality. But if this is so, then any worship of God would be idolatry. For as Cobb acknowledges, idolatry is treating something as ultimate that is less than ultimate. So God is either an impossible self-caused being, or else he is being caused by another being which is uncaused. In the latter case, creativity becomes the functional substitute for what process theologians wish to avoid in classical theism, namely an uncaused cause on which all else depends. In brief, the only way to make process theology coherent is to return to classical theism. Thank you.
I'm allowed 10 minutes to prove that process thought is biblical, Christian, and coherent. I won't succeed. I think that perhaps I'll approach these in the reverse order, because in the last section we were obviously we engaged in a metaphysical debate about the nature of reality. And I can't say enough, I'm sure, to be very convincing, but I would like just to try to highlight what the issue is. And if this had been scheduled as a debate on the two metaphysical systems, I would have begun here rather than somewhere else. Almost all philosophical thought acknowledges that there are entities, objects, and let's just call them substances, just to, as a way of talking about them, like a cup or a table or a star or whatever. I mean, the world is made up of things in this very obvious sense. And then everybody agrees also that there are happenings, occurrences, events. And in the great majority of the Western philosophical tradition, the objects or substances, things like cups and human bodies and tables and chairs and so forth, have been taken to be the primary realities. And events have been understood as the result of the motion of such bodies. The modern world has thought in terms of matter in motion. There are material objects and they move. And according to how they are then spatially related to each other, we get a cup in one case or a table in another or something of that sort. So events are secondary to objects. Now, process thought reverses that and holds that events are the prior fundamental metaphysical realities, and that objects are the secondary derivative entities. Now, this is partly the result of the direction that modern science has gone in its understanding of subatomic phenomena and so forth. It's also partly the result of reflection upon the human situation and many other things. Now, I don't want to say this is biblical. I mean, the Bible is not a book of metaphysics. It doesn't take clear stands on metaphysical issues. But there have been biblical scholars who have pointed out that the Bible focuses much more upon occurrences and events, whereas Greek thought focuses much more upon objects and entities. So there are some respects, at least, in which opting for the metaphysics of event or process instead of the metaphysics of substance and objects has congeniality at a certain level. I don't want to say it is biblical. I just want to say there is some congeniality with ancient Hebrew modes of thought when one moves in that direction. But it does change the way we think about everything. There's no question about its radical character. And if you take for granted the habits of mind that have been shaped under substance metaphysics, then it does sound incoherent. And I understand that, but I'm just saying there is a whole other way of looking at things which make coherent what appears to be incoherent when you start from a different point of view. A very crucial issue is, of course, the understanding of the self. And it is the case that our language has taken the pronoun I as an example, and because we are so accustomed to using the pronoun I, we have a very strong sense that there must be some kind of an object or substance that corresponds with it, that has a reality somehow sort of like the kind of reality that a cup has. Now, I don't mean to say anybody would say it was like a cup, but still, in the Western tradition, it is often thought of as being a substance. So there is some kind of a substantial self underlying the experiences that the self has. And the word I refers to that. So you'd say it's nonsense to talk about thinking unless there is first an I that may or may not be thinking, that at this particular moment is engaged in thinking. Dr. Geisler made several of these analogies. I think he tripped himself up a little bit in talking about raining, because it's true, we don't just say raining, we say it is raining. But if you really press the question of what that it is, you'll find it's a rather elusive entity that is doing the raining. And in a... So if you would take that analogy and press it, you come out more on the event side than you would on the substance side, I think. But that's not a proof of anything. I'm just throwing it out as a comment on the extreme difficulty. Now, there is only one major tradition of highly sophisticated thinking that has for a long, long period of time operated in process terms, and that is in Buddhism. Buddhism made a move about 2,500 years ago in its criticism of Hinduism that resembles the move of process philosophy in its critique of substantialist of philosophy in the West. So it's a large topic, and it is certainly true that because especially the Indo-European languages put such a priority upon the noun and the pronoun, it's exceedingly difficult even to communicate the full significance of a process point of view without wrestling against the language that one is using. So I wish simply to acknowledge the extreme difficulty. I think one shouldn't too quickly say it's incoherent, because it has to rub against the grains of deeply established habit. It is not quite the case that process thought puts God and the world in sheer ontological parity, as if there were no priority to be assigned to either one. Dr. Geisler may find me or someone else in a careless moment using very extreme language there, because we do so want to stress that there is interaction between God's experience and the experiences of the world. But in Whitehead's formulation, and I think this should be true of most process philosophers, there is a primordial decision on the part of God from which everything else flows. And that is, all human decisions are finally within the context of a primordial divine decision. So that's just a comment about the fact, I think, as he was pushing matters, one could very well end up in an incoherent position. Relation is a relation of past to present. Now, from my point of view, and I think most process thinkers would agree, if all causation is from past to present, then there can finally be no freedom in the present. And everything in the present is explicable in terms of the past. And this, you end up in a deterministic system. It's very important for us to assert what Dr. Geisler thought was inherently incoherent, namely self-causation within an event. So that in our analysis, in every moment, there is an element of the determination of what happens in that moment that is made in the moment in which it happens. Now, again, whether that's coherent or incoherent depends upon the matrix of assumptions with which you approach it. But I think if you deny that you ultimately would have an extremely difficult task in affirming human responsibility. The business about being biblical and Christian, of course, is a very, very large topic. It's certainly the case that the process philosophers, such as Whitehead, are not functioning as interpreters of the Bible. I, on the other hand, think Whitehead is far more influenced by the Bible than Aristotle, who played such a large role in the formation of classical theism. But it is a weakness on the part of many of us process theologians that we are not better biblical scholars and that we do not make more use. I think you'd have to go through this in more detail to see just how true that is. Let me make one final statement. I have my comment about the doctrine of the Trinity, which was a very negative comment, if abstracted from the fact that I say I think that the Trinity is very important. I think that the way in which the doctrine of the Trinity got formulated and used in the course of Christian history, it finally became a kind of word game about just what one had to affirm. So I have made very negative comments about the doctrine of the Trinity. I'm not making negative comments about the Trinity. I just want to say, okay, I have a red flag here. That's why I'm stopping.
Let me begin at that point. In Process Theology on page 109, as a matter of fact, there are negative comments about the traditional classical doctrine of the Trinity itself, not simply how it is worded. In fact, Professor Cobb believes that there is, in the modern sense, only one person in God, he says, in the traditional sense, two persons, and if you take two sides of each of these, he believes in his own word a quaternity, which is hardly an orthodox presentation of the Trinity. On the question of God and time, he says the eternal is truly real, not time is the classical way of putting it, but of course that's a straw man with regard to classical theism, whereas you could argue that way for Aristotle or Plato. You cannot argue that way for Aquinas or Anselm or for any of the classical theists who believe that time is real. It is not an illusion. It is not Maya. It is just as real as eternity is. The Bible, he says, teaches that God is not eternal. Well, I would commend to you, and I will share later, that the Bible teaches that God is eternal. Exodus 3:14, I am that I am. The Bible teaches that God is before all the ages, that he framed the ages, that he is before time. All of those are phrases taken directly from biblical passages. How can God know what is going on now? He asks as a problem. Of course, that's a classic category mistake. Category mistake is assuming that an eternal being must know in the same way that a temporal being does. God can know what temporal beings know, but he doesn't have to know how they know. In fact, if he's eternal, he knows eternally. If he's infinite, he knows infinitely. And simply because God can't know finitely is no handicap for an infinite God. And simply because God can't know temporally is no handicap for an eternal God. The Bible doesn't take clear stands on metaphysical issues, Professor Cobb said. I would suggest the Bible does take clear stands on metaphysical issues. Theism versus atheism is a metaphysical issue. I think the Bible takes a clear stand on that. Theism versus pantheism is a metaphysical issue. I think the Bible takes a clear stand on that. The grass is not God, as pantheists say. The Bible teaches that God made the grass, not that God is the grass. Professor Cobb says grace is stressed in process theology as opposed to the classical view. I would suggest that just the opposite is the case. As a matter of fact, Professor Cobb makes a very strong statement here in page 114. Justification by faith is an incredible doctrine. Well, I would think the Bible teaches justification by faith, and it's not an incredible doctrine, and that the classical view held by all of the men that I mentioned is a doctrine that also stresses the grace of God through Jesus Christ very much. I was mystified by the statements that non-sensory experiences are more important, particularly in light of the fact that Professor Cobb said that time is real and history is real. If time is real and history is real, and that's where our knowledge begins, and Jesus Christ is the one who is God come to focus in human history, is God incarnate in human flesh, then I would assume that one would take just the opposite point of view, that the empirical is very important in discovering the historical, and that the historical is absolutely crucial in understanding Christianity. We've already commented on his statements that truth is relative. I think that that's a self-defeating claim. How can you claim that truth is relative? Is that a relative truth claim or an absolute truth claim? If it's absolute, it's self-defeating. If it's relative, it's baseless. Professor Cobb, to sharpen the differences, also denies the biblical teaching of ex nihilo creation. He said this is part and parcel of the doctrine of God as the absolute controller. He insists that God works persuasively, not coercively, and therefore ex nihilo creation is wrong. But if this is right, then I would think that we would have to argue that it would be immoral to push a stalled car rather than luring it into another place. If force on material objects is wrong, then one wonders how processed theologians get food from their plate into their mouth. Certainly they don't coax it in. Force is not inherently wrong if it's used on non-moral objects. I think his point is exactly right if he's talking about moral beings. You can't force moral beings to do anything, but I take it that the inanimate world is not a moral being. Also, he speaks of the question of determination. The classical view of God would eliminate free choice. Determination and free choice are no more contradictory than the fact that I chose to wear a blue shirt yesterday is contradictory to the fact that this decision is now determined forever. And God sees the future with the same determinative ability, greater, actually, than we see the past. Actually, it's not the classical theist belief in determination that's inconsistent, but it's the process theologian's belief in universalism. For process, God cannot guarantee, as Professor Cobb believes, that everyone will eventually be saved without tampering with their freedom. But as process theology acknowledges, coercion is contrary to free choice. Hence, either universalism is wrong, or else God must coerce the unwilling. As to the question of impassibility and the insensitivity of God, Professor Cobb, as is common process theologians, quote the classical theists out of context. They are not denying that God has feeling. They are denying that God has dependent feeling, that God has changeless feeling. And if God has changeless character and changeless intention, as Professor Cobb said, then why can't God have changeless feeling? As a matter of fact, the Bible says God grieves over sinners. He hates sin. He takes pleasure in his servants and rejoices when sinners repent. I assume he'd even rejoice if a process theologian repented. However, while God feels good about good and he feels bad about evil, these feelings never change. God always has exactly the same feeling toward injustice. He doesn't feel differently today and tomorrow about injustice. When something changes, it's not God. When the man who is standing on the right side of the pillar moves to the left side of the pillar doesn't change, the man does. And when a man changes in relationship to God, God doesn't change in relationship to man. That's the basic error, as I see it, of process theology. Also, to argue that sovereignty or omnipotence is contrary to human responsibility is, I think, fallacious. He claims that if all is in the hands of a good and omnipotent God, who will care for us? Why should we have any concern about things? All sense of urgency to do good disappears. Confident Christians, he said, become complacent Christians. However, you could argue with equal force that discouraged Christians lose hope. Why fight for a cause of justice when we have no assurance that we'll ever win. According to process theologian, we don't have any assurance that God is ever going to win in the battle against evil, that there's ever going to be a final victory. Now, why fight for a cause? We have no assurance that it can ultimately triumph. The process God can't guarantee victory in the struggle for evil. After thousands of years that God has been working, and of course on even more cosmic time scales for process theologians, after millions of years that God has been working, there is no perceptible difference in terms of the progress over evil in the world. And if that's the case, then why should we try if God can't do any better? Furthermore, there's no contradiction between omnipotence and moral duty, or sovereignty and moral duty. The fact that God is all-powerful or sovereign does not mean that I'm not morally responsible. God is responsible for the fact of my free choice. I'm responsible for the acts of my free choice. As creator, God is responsible for giving us free choice, but as creatures, we're indictable for the free choice that we exercise. I think the main difference between process theology and classical theology is that classical theology believes that there is an unchanging substance and that God engages in changing activities, whereas process theology has reduced God to the changing activities. It has, in effect, negated the unchanging actor while it stresses the changing actions. It has negated the essence of God while it stresses the activity of God. God is more than activity. Raindrops are more than raining. And they're not as elusive as Professor Cobb admits. Anyone who was out today in the downpour knows that it was pretty hard to elude all of the drops of rain. There must be something there in order for it to be changing. The classical concept that there was an unchanging substance, that there were changing accidents and changing relationships, is far more coherent than saying, as the tortured linguistic dissertation that Professor Cobb gave us about the ineptness of language to explain the process view reveals, it is more than a linguistic difficulty. It is a philosophical impossibility to have something change without something changing. To say that I am simply a series, to use Professor Hartshorne's own fraction, every 1/10 to 1/20 of a second, I am an entirely new creation. There's a series of annihilations and recreations, and Professor Hartshorne carried this so far, I'm not sure Professor Cobb would, he can comment on that, is to say that when one goes into sleep and he is awakened out of sleep, he actually comes back into existence. Whether that's true or not is certainly the case that Professor Cobb must admit, that as far as actual entities occur, to use Whiteheadian terms, there is only a split-second existence. They cease to exist, and a new one is created, so that since the time I began 10 minutes ago to give this rebuttal, 9 minutes ago, to give this rebuttal, I am actually thousands of different persons, a series of thousands of little I. There was no continuing I. There was no continuing me behind the whole thing. You just saw as a rather illusory series of entities disappearing and reappearing. I commend to you that that is not a coherent view of the self. It's not a coherent view of reality, and it's not a coherent view of God.
Format will be that I will start off by asking Dr. Cobb one of the questions that was raised for him. When he has finished answering the question to his satisfaction, then Dr. Geiser can also comment either on the question or the response or how he might respond to the question. Then we'll go to Dr. Geiser with Dr. Cobb responding. To Dr. Cobb, the question was raised, how do I know when I arrived at truth, if truth is relative to what is understood now and is based on changing science, philosophies, and etc., which soon will prove to be in the future to be untrue? In other words, why should I even bother to engage in thinking about God when I can never know if what I'm thinking is true? This seems like an exercise in futility.
Thank you. Yes, if you feel that it's only worthwhile thinking if you grasp a final and ultimate truth through the process of thinking, I do personally think it's probably an exercise in futility. I mean, just take a much simpler matter, trying to understand yourself and why you have the attitudes and opinions that you now have. Now, I think you can get a lot of insight into that, but if you think you can really grasp the totality of the truth about why you think the way you do about something, I think you're probably wrong. I think you'll learn more about it tomorrow and more about it the next day if you keep open and sensitive and digging, and that it's not just a matter of adding, but each time you get a new insight into yourself, all the old understandings that you had of yourself change a little bit. So I think we're in the same situation in science or anywhere else. I don't think many scientists believe that they have a final formulation about the nature of the physical world. There are lots of confusions and loose ends in all the major sciences. But that doesn't mean that our ability to interact intelligently and effectively with the world is not being continually increased by the advance of understanding. So I don't think you have to suppose that there must be a set of propositions that are inerrant in the sciences or anywhere else in order to find the activity of investigation and rethinking a useful and fruitful one. I hope that's the case for you.
I think it's helpful to distinguish between absolute truth and a less than absolute grasp of the truth. And whereas we all acknowledge that at any given time our understanding may be only an approximation of the truth, it is quite a different thing to say that truth itself is relative. And I think what we need to say is that truth is absolute, though our understanding of it may be less than absolute. The truth is absolute even though the evidence for that given truth may be less than absolute, but I think it becomes incoherent when we contend that truth itself is relative. And that, I think, is the essential problem with process theology.
To Dr. Geisler was addressed this question. Dr. Gobb has asserted that classical theology is largely rooted in Greek philosophy. Do you concur?
No, that's one of the classical misunderstandings of classical theology. Classical theology is rooted in the Bible. Classical theology springs out of the God of the Old Testament and the New Testament. It does not come out of Aristotle. Aristotle obviously didn't get his ideas from the Bible. Aristotle didn't have a Bible. On the other hand, Whitehead did, and he still didn't get his ideas from the Bible. The best that Aquinas was doing, and I think anyone who has studied Aquinas carefully will understand, that Aquinas was simply taking the truth of Augustine and putting it into the terms of Aristotle. He was using Aristotelian terminology, but he was using Augustinian truth. And he thought himself as in continuity with Augustine, and he was on virtually every major issue with regard to the existence of God and the deity of Christ and the Trinity and all essential Christian doctrines. So I think because they used Greek terminology by no means means that they have borrowed Greek truth. They borrowed the truth from the scriptures, which they quoted hundreds and thousands of times, and they articulated a Christian view, as all of us do, in terms of the language that is current in their day, trying as carefully as possible to distinguish the Christian truth from the Greek error that they were very, very interested in rejecting, even though they had to use the terminology that the Greeks used because that was the language that was current in their time.
I hope that I didn't give the impression that I thought that classical Christian theology was simply Greek philosophy. I tried to say that in the process of articulating Christian thought wisely and intelligently in the early centuries of the church, and I should say in a certain period it was more Plato than Aristotle, and then it was Neoplatonism, And Neoplatonism draws on both Platonic and Aristotelian elements, and it was quite important in shaping the Augustinian synthesis. But, of course, Augustine and Thomas were arguing against many features of Greek thought at the same time that they were appropriating other features of Greek thought. So I think that Dr. Geisler has somewhat understated the importance of the conceptuality that they made use of. And, of course, in my presentation, I was focusing upon certain values that God expressed. And I think there is a distinction between eternity in a non-temporal sense and everlastingness. That means that there is no beginning and end, but there is a processive character to the life of that which is everlasting. And I think at that point it would be hard to argue that both Augustine and Thomas did not follow the non-temporal notion of eternity, rather than the enduring through time way of thinking that is more characteristic of the Bible.
A large number of questions were addressed to Dr. Cobb, which would like clarification about your views of Jesus.
Well, I'll try to give a Christology in 2 minutes. Okay. I think because of the way the issue was brought up, that probably I should focus on the doctrine of the incarnation. There are, of course, many other features of a Christology. I happen to feel very congenial with the formulation in the prologue to John's Gospel. There it begins by speaking of the Word that was with God and was God everlastingly. And I think that the doctrine of the Trinity actually got its chief root. You remember that the doctrine of the Trinity was chiefly formed in terms of the relationship of the Father and the Word. That there was not nearly as much intense discussion about the third person of the Trinity. Once it was worked out in relationship to the relation between the Father and the Word, that same kind of pattern could be extended to the Holy Spirit without anything like a comparable debate. Now, what it says in the Gospel of John is that nothing was created except through the Word, and all life is the presence of the Word in the world. And there is no understanding, there is no light in human beings except as the Word enlightens us. Now, it is this Word that functioned creatively and enliveningly and illuminatingly in the creation that we are then told became flesh in Jesus. And I understand Jesus as the incarnation of this Word. Now, sometimes people say, what you must affirm is that Jesus is God, or that Jesus is the second person of the Trinity. I'm very uncomfortable with that language, and I do not use it, so that if that's what one is looking for, I have to say no. That to me would mean that the incarnate Word was everlasting, and I don't think that's really what should be meant by the doctrine of the Trinity. That which is present to us in Jesus, the divinity that is present to us in Jesus, is not a subordinate divinity. It is not a creature. It is not inferior to the Father. It is the Word that is God. And I think we can speak of the Holy Spirit in similar terms. Now, I think we don't have to use the word Word, and we don't have to use the word Son. I think we could use the word Wisdom. And there are places in Paul that it seems more that it is the wisdom of God that is incarnate in Jesus. In other words, I am critical of trying to zero in and say one of these terms must be retained and held fast to under all circumstances. I think we can be more fluid than that in our identification. But I do believe that Jesus is the incarnation of the Word, and that the Word is God, in not any subordinate sense. That's at least the beginning of the formulation of elements of orthodoxy. But I do quarrel with some of the ways these things got developed in the course of later teaching. I quarrel with the I don't quarrel with Chalcedon, but I do quarrel with what has come to be in the West usually thought of as the orthodox interpretation of Chalcedon. In each of the creedal controversies, even after Chalcedon, it was always insisted that in Jesus there was fully present the human element as well as the divine element. But subsequently there came to be an interpretation of Chalcedon that said, but when you get to the self or the I or the ultimate subject, that is purely God and not human. I object to that. I do not think that it's biblical. I do not think that it is stated in the creeds, but it's often regarded as orthodoxy. So it's a complicated matter to say in a few minutes how one relates oneself to a long traditional debate.